Hello, homies. Today we have a return guest, Dr. Paul Theriault, who was also on episode 122 of this show when we spoke about triturations. And he is definitely pushing the limits when it comes to triturations, but also he has created an incredible body of work called The Table of Animals, which is what we're going to be talking about today. He has written several books on this topic. He is finishing off his book on birds, and you can actually get copies of these books at www.lulu.com. That's lulu.com, and you will find his books there. This was such a deep and interesting conversation. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you will too. If you would like to join the discussion, come and join the Homeopathy Hangout podcast Facebook group. Dr. Paul is in there as well, and you're always welcome to ask him some questions about today's episode. Thanks so much for listening.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we have our lovely return guest, Dr. Paul Theriault. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's lovely to have you back on, and it's been lovely to have you in our Homeopathy Hangout Facebook group. There's been a few members that have asked you questions in there. We've had lots of lovely feedback from your past episode on the show, and you just blew our minds with triturations. And that actually, your episode inspired me to reach out to Sally Moore, who's a homeopath here in Perth and who's done lots of triturations. And I actually did my first ever trituration with her. So it was just, her and four others. And we didn't know what the substance was. She did. We knew it was going to be a native Australian plant. And it ended up being the West Australian Christmas tree, which was really, really cool. Ooh. So yesterday, the triturated substance got sent off to Mike at Similimum in New Zealand, and he's going to be turning that into a remedy for us. And I think I'd be quite keen to do another proving of the substance after that. Maybe we can send you some too.
That would be nice. How high did you go?
It was very, do you know what's very interesting is that there was some, like a lot of joking kind of around death. And at the time, I didn't think it had anything to do with the trituration and kind of like the joke that we talked about, like, this sounds terrible, horrible ways to die. And that song, Dumb Ways to Die, kept on, like, it was kind of like a theme throughout the 2 days because we did up to a C4. And right at the end, well, somebody said, it would be horrible to die by trituration, you know, to be triturated. And I thought, crucifixion would be the most horrible way. And then when we found out the substance, you know, at the time thinking it had nothing to do with it, but then found out the substance, and actually in the Noongar culture, the local Aboriginal native people, this is actually a tree where the spirit of their ancestors go before they go on to the next life. And so something that we thought had nothing to do with it turned out to actually have a bit of a theme to the remedy. So, and I had a really wacky dream as well. So, yeah, this is me just taking over, but I have to tell you about the wacky dream, because we did the first two triturations the one day and the next two triturations the next day. And that first night, I dreamt that I was holding my cat in my arms, and my daughter said, "Mummy, look at Mishka." And I looked down at the cat, and it had this huge lump on its head. And the next second, the lump went down and blood poured out of her mouth and out of her butt. The next day, we went to this park, and my daughter bashed her head, and she had this huge lump on her head and blood was pouring out the side of her head. And I'm like, okay, this is really freaky.
So there's a bit of an element of clairvoyance to it as well.
Possibly. It wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, I am looking forward to when we use the remedy again, seeing more. But we're going to get Sally on the show once she's written up everyone's notes and come and do a proper talk about it. I know Sally's been in touch with you because your work really inspires her. And yeah, I mean, you inspired me to do my first ever trituration. So thank you. That was a very long intro, but
yeah,
that's not what we're talking about today. And easily this can become a conversation about trituration. But what are we going to be talking about today, Paul? Because we had
triturations dominate everything. So,
well, you had a lot of listeners reach out to you after the show asking you for more information about animal systems. Talk to us a little bit about that. You take the floor.
So one of my projects that I've been doing that, strangely enough, I'm less well known for, but I think is perhaps one of the more important projects, is systematizing the animal materia medica. So I started this in 2014. I'd been in practice 3 or 4 years. I thought, this will be up a 300-page book or something. And it's at 3,000 pages a book. And 7 volumes. And I think it's, yeah, it turned into a much larger monster than I thought it was. But it's been a really long time coming. And it has been founded in trituration methodology. Every group of animals I write about, I will triturate. So I will go and personally experience them myself. I'm like, oh, this is what this animal is like. And so I'm explaining this right now to get a good, to kind of start spreading the word about, just like we have systematized various other groups in homeopathy, we, like I have systematized the animals. And there's a number of people attempting to do this right now, and they're coming up with a lot of definitions and kind of divisions of the animal kingdom that perhaps aren't as zoologically appropriate. So there's a little bit of it. So I'm starting to do publicity and kind of like, all right, this is how the animal kingdom works. And this is how I've kind of divided it up. Because I think just that basis and personal experience does kind of make the difference there.
So actually, why do you, because we've had the minerals have been kind of systematized for a while now, and then the plants after that, but why do you think the animals got left to last?
I don't know. And it may simply be like, that is the order of constitutions, isn't it? They always said the plants and then the minerals and then the animals and so forth. Can't even divided them up. You know, these are the, so maybe that was just destiny or something like that. But yeah, no, I'm not sure why they were last. Animals are more complicated. They're not quite as complicated as plants. I mean, I do hope you one day have Michal Yakir on here, because Michal is just a doll.
We've had several conversations to try and get her on. So believe me, I have tried. I will continue trying.
I love Michal. I've studied with her extensively and collaborated with her in some of her triturations and from her next book. Animals aren't quite as complicated as plants, but they're very complicated. Like the periodic table, perhaps one of the reasons it came first was because it's easy.
And there's a system just in place already. I guess there's a system in place, like zoologically and botanically, a system in place. But with the minerals, there's that, the periodic table. It's all kind of set out there. So I can understand why that one got systematized first.
It's very easy. Animals are more complicated. So with animals, the basic, so you need to know a little zoology to get to do this. But so animals, there are the basic division of the animal kingdom is a phyla. So a phyla is a group of animals. They've recently been reorganized into things called superphyla that go together. And when I looked at the provings of different superphyla, they shared a theme. They would be different elaborations of the same theme. So this actually made it so they're very easy to systematize them. So there are about 6 superphyla, and you just see animals as they, and you know, as a superphyla advances, the consciousness kind of gets more advanced, and they move throughout the structure that we would call that Jan Scholten described and that Michal Yakir described. They all move through the same structure. It's just they move through it in a very different context, in the context of the animal kingdom and these 6 superphyla. 3 of which are actually pretty big.
And what are some of the topics that your books explore, and what can people expect to read out of that, and when's it going to be done? I should probably ask that at the end, but you know, I like to put the horse in front of the cart, or the cart in front of the horse.
Every volume except the birds is done.
Okay.
So I may go back and issue a second edition of some of them, because some of them I don't think I did justice to, and I got better at it, at triturating and everything after 8 years. But that's kind of the, no, it's been 9 years now, but they've all been published, and I'm currently working on the birds. I was actually, earlier this morning, I was transcribing Cuculus canoris, the cuckoo, so which is a fun little remedy. And I'm doing some other explorations. The birds is going to be my most extensive book, so I'm about halfway done right now.
So how many of them have you, like the animals that are in there, have you triturated them all yourself? Surely not, because I mean, that would be gazillions. No, it was okay. But
particularly for the mammals and the birds, I've done one from each group.
Okay.
So my bird trituration, my bird book will have about 20 triturations in it.
Okay.
And people don't understand that, but the original bird book by Shore and Annika Hoagland and Judy Shreveman, to God rest both of their souls, Annika's still alive, but Judy and Jonathan have passed away. That was originally based in trituration. So all of those remedies in Jonathan Shore's bird book, the original one in 2005, were triturated, and that's how they came up with those. So I'm just kind of elaborating that theme, and mine's going to have about 20 in it when it's all done.
Oh, that's really cool. I actually recently got received an email from Danica. Yeah. So Danica recently got in touch with me and said that you and Angelica are doing a proving and if I'd be interested as well. But I had just done that trituration, and I guess you should probably give at least 3 months between triturations or provings or things like that. So I didn't want to go straight into that one when I just done this one in case there was more things of the remedy that comes up. So for you as well, with doing all the triturations and provings that you're doing, do you leave like a period of time between each one, or do you find you can easily flow from one to the next?
There are times when I do a remedy with Michal in the morning, and there's times when I do my remedy at night. I'm just really? I've done this so much. I'm in this state now. Oh, I'm back to me. I leave it in the bowl, and then I'm like, oh, I'm going to be this one. So I don't have a problem with that.
But that comes with time as well, surely. I mean, you wouldn't have been able to do that at the start.
No. Okay. If you're starting out, it's leave a little time.
Okay, because I do remember Jan Schulten, he said, because he proved the lanthanides on himself, and I'm pretty sure he also said that he could take like the doses pretty much one after the other and could identify which one did what, which, I mean, that fascinates me so much that you're able to go in and out of that state. Because some people get profound... Yeah, some people get affected so profoundly by the provings that they sometimes, you know, they'll have like years later, but I guess that's probably maybe people that haven't done it quite as much. But anyway... Back to your book. With your triturations, where do you get the substances from? And is it like, I know with a lot of animal substances, they use like one drop of blood and a feather or things like that. Like what sort of substances do you tend to use?
The substances do have a slight effect. People send me stuff a lot. Like I've got a ton of feathers. I went to a biological supply laboratory and they sent me a bunch of stuff and I somehow got it across the border and everything. That was really weird. Like that never happens in Canada for like stuff like that. Like the CB, like Canadian border services are super intense, but it somehow worked. So I just got a lot of live samples and I've started using more prepared remedies recently. So it turns out you can retriturate a remedy that's already like you've got a 30C of it or something. You can retriturate it if you're very clear in your intent. I'm starting at C1 and just start there. So that's where I've been doing a lot of them lately as well.
I'm just thinking, is that the conversation that you had with Danica then? Because she said to me that she spoke with you and you told her that she could kind of retriturate the golden spiral. So I didn't really know what she meant, but maybe this is what that was on about then, retriturating that.
Golden spiral is a remedy. I've read through it. It is a very interesting one. It needed to go higher. Remember the conversation we had a while ago about how that 1-4 is the personal and 5-8 is like what the golden spiral describes is more of a cosmic geometrical set that is on a, I think, multiversal level. So I'd encourage Danica to go up to C28 with that.
Yeah, see, you are just all over the place, Paul, because right here in this trituration handbook that Sally loaned me is actually a little printout that's from you. About the different levels. It's actually got your name on it. And it says here, C1-4, the individual and their own issues. C5-8, the collective, ranging from the familial to country, culture, and civilization. C9-12, planetary resonance with the planet Earth. C13-16, solar level. 17-20, galaxies. 21-24, universal. And 25-28, divine. It hasn't got 50 on here, which you did with your blood, though. So what? That's just like next level.
That was intense. So going past 12 is a little exciting because you start to contend with things. Before 12, you're just kind of like, oh, I'm living my life. And then after 12, it's like, wow. But anyway, I did that for up to C12 for each of them. And it's very interesting because I do think that had a planetary energetic effect. I do think that there's a pathway of conscious. I mean, when I've done this, and Michal talks about this as well, there is an evolutionary path that Earth is taking, and you can see it in the advancement of life forms as they unfold over time. You know, the difference of a bird and a sponge is considerable. Like that's the journey I've taken, is journeying from these basic, like sponges are all about, do I exist or not? Do I want to exist? What do I need to exist? How do I fit my little spark of consciousness into this body and everything else like that? And there's not a lot there. There's not a lot of development there. A lot of people, beings who kind of have sponges, they've kind of gotten their energetic bodies shredded and they're just a floating spark of consciousness. And the sponge is the first leap back into the living kingdoms where they can rebuild and reclaim what they've lost, what's been space dusted and everything. So consider comparing that to a bird. because a sponge is the direct ancestor of a bird, even if it's separated by like 700 or 800 million years. And to a bird, a vastly realized being expanding beyond their body, expanding into these transpersonal expansive realms that we use in the lower titration levels will often like attach to like the word freedom or like, you know, space or sky or flying or anything out that like that. They are getting attached to these realms outside of themselves, and this perfection is just like, it's a huge journey, and Earth has made it over the past probably 800 to 900 million years. And you see that, and it's just gigantic when you see the growth of consciousness between those two kind of polarities of the animal journey.
And another question I have for you is, did you find that with all these volumes that you've written in 3,000 pages, that there was a journey that you went on to go from one super filler to the next? Or was that, did you just go, okay, I'm going to start here and end here? Or was there a journey in that as well?
Oh, no. I'm like, I'm going to start with the sponges and I'm going to end with the birds. It's just, I didn't expect to know how long that was going to take or how many remedies I was going to do. So I'm still on that journey. I am most of the way through the birds now. I got about 10 left. I don't know. I've got some other projects after that. But I do think, so as a society, if you wanted to characterize us, we are in layer 6 right now. We are in this kind of, you might equate it to gold series or to the mammals or to Hymenoptera, the bees and the ants, or to the beetles, or kind of to the Asterales in Michel's work. It is a concern with overall social functioning, with justice, rightness and wrongness, and how everyone is treating each other and so forth. We are firmly there. 100% we are there. We are moving to that next level of the birds and also the butterflies and the flies to a lesser or to an equal extent. But I think we're really moving into that bird state where it is more an emphasis on individual fulfillment. What am I? Who am I? What am I put here to do? What is the thing that I bring to the reality that no one else can? There is this like ideas of destiny, of purpose and calling and everything. That is really the focus of the birds. Their freedom, their sense of expansion is falling into that, is doing that actively. So we are making that shift. Ironically enough, the recent infection that was going around was very much, it did, I think, as we all got infected. I don't know about you in Australia, everyone, like the infection rates in Canada have been virtually 100%. So you're living in a hermitage somewhere and haven't had no contact for the last 3 years, you've gotten it. By moving through that, we've kind of shifted a little bit. Like that particular infection kind of moved people, starts society from that place in column 6 to column 7, this new bird energy. So it is, I've gone on it, and as I've gone on it, society's gone on it a little bit. And I think there has been kind of a planetary energetic shift, not a vast one, not everyone's there yet, but there's been a little bit of a forward momentum moving throughout this journey I've taken things on.
I know, I sometimes feel like we're, oh, there's this shift. And then I just go and read like comments on like, you know, random Facebook pages and things. And I'm like, yep, no, humanity's still far back in the dark ages.
Well, we need to be patient. The old school esotericists would say something about, what is it, the next iteration of humanity arising in 6,000 years or something like that. So I'm like, all right, we've got some time. Or I'm not saying I accept that, but, you know, we need to be a little bit patient. A shift happens over the course of centuries and thousands of years.
And it's not going to be like nothing and next second it's there. It's going to be a journey, and it's going to be good and bad along the way. Can you maybe talk to us a little bit about the super filler? What are they? What are the main kind of themes of each one?
So we've talked a little bit about the sponges already. The sponges are one super filler. We have 3 sponge remedies that are known in any great detail. I should have made more. I didn't.
Maybe a reason for that, because they're,
I think we need more of them. But the second superphyla is the cnidarians. So cnidarians are corals and jellyfish. So their whole thing is they are very much in that column 2, that layer 2. There's a barrier between me and the outside world. Their barrier doesn't work. It goes in and it like fries them. They're completely discombobulated by it. Often, and there's a lot of neurological stuff that goes along with that. one of the remedies that I added to the Materia Medica was Physalia physalis, because I had a bunch of cases of it. And they, when they get into that state of being frazzled, being like discombobulated by the outside world, they just go blank. I've seen it in a lot of people with like diabetes and blood sugar issues, and they just have blackouts. Like, well, apparently I was doing everything normally, but I don't remember anything. And I had a blood sugar low and I was just acting normally. And then I came to, out of it like 8 hours later and I'm at home now. I don't know what I did. So it's like that kind of weird blood sugar thing. There's a consistent thing there. And there's also a lot of brain injuries that occur. Mm-hmm. The other one is it's the tenophora. So tenophora are like jellyfish, but so jellyfish kind of go and they have this like whole body pulsing motion. Mm-hmm. Tenophores, they have little tentacles all along them and they're just always kind of flickering all of the time. So they look like jellyfish, but they're completely different. There is one remedy that I made, Memniopsis macridi, and their whole thing is very much about, where do I want to go in life? Do I want to actively exert effort, or do I want to just kind of go with the flow, even though it might take me someplace nasty? So there's one remedy. I did it. That is what we got. I encourage people to prove more of those things. There still is one remedy in the Materia Medica, even though I did that like in 2015 or anything. So no one's taken up my challenge there. Those are the three small superphyla. The next three ones are the big ones. The first of which is the Lophotrochozoa. So the Lophotrochozoa are the worms, the mollusks, and several smaller phyla, and maybe the platyhelminths, which are like the tube worms or flatworms. So the mollusks really are the most well-known of these. And the whole issue with the Lophotrochozoa is the safe zone, as I call it. It is an environment in which people can live effectively, a good place. Just, this is what I need out of life. So in the more primitive ones, like the annelids, the worms, they're in layer three. It's all about individuality. Who am I? They feel if they are going to get kicked out, if they just kind of differentiate themselves from the safe zone, they're in it. I'm like, oh, if I'm actually who I am I going to get kicked out of this? Am I still going to have access? And we see the reaction to that. Lumbricus terrestris is one such remedy, and there's this incredible guilt, this like feeling of shame about the self and everything. So I'm like, oh, I can't be me, I suck, and so forth. The mollusks are the biggest group in there. They've got, you know, quite a few remedies. They're all about, oh, they're column four. They're all, I need to take responsibility for perpetuating this safe zone, this place where I can live. Well, crap, I can't. This is hard. So what do we have in there? Calcarb. People think of calcarb as a mineral. Calcarb is not a mineral. Calcarb is oyster shell. So we just, I can't do this. I need you all to help me with this. I need this. I need my family to do this with me. Oh my, and you get all the fears of being alone, of being abandoned, because they can't possibly maintain responsibility for all of this by themselves. So that's very typical of that kind of bivalve thing. There's like a shutting down and a withdrawal because they just can't handle it.
Casually dropped like a bomb there, which I'm just like, how did I not think this through? But you're right, like calcarb is made from oyster shell, but we think of it as a mineral remedy.
Now, calcium and calc, there is quite a bit in common there. Like they're not associated together for the wrong reason, but it's absolutely an oyster shell.
But our calcarb remedy is made from oyster shell. Is there a different calc?
There may be.
Yeah, I'm just like, I don't know. Yeah, interesting. Okay. It's so blindingly obvious. And I'm just thinking like, how do we always talk about it as a mineral remedy when it's made from an oyster shell? Anyway, that's all right. Leave that I'll process that.
This is one of the problems I have with some homeopathic teaching. So I think, Will Taylor used to always say we should call it calcarea austriatum, something like that.
Yeah.
To differentiate it. It's a good idea.
Yeah.
And then we go to like, you know, with the snails, we get to murex. They do a very similar thing. So what is murex? Murex really gets themselves some protection. They actually succeed at getting themselves help. And they usually do through like sex. Like murex is typically someone who's got a sexual relationship with someone who's like big and tough and scary. Mm. And it's like, oh, this is my guy. He keeps me safe. Mm. Yeah. And everything. And they've got a lot of sexual dysfunction as well that tends to go along with it. A lot of like female pathology. Mm. And then we go to the most advanced mollusks, the cephalopods, the octopuses. What's our big famous remedy there? CPR.
Yeah, sorry, my friend. I told you I had to get up really early this morning, so my brain's only CPR, which I live on and which I prescribe all day long.
So they are actually succeeding. It's like every cephalopod has an environment, like they each have a different one that's all about keeping this safe.
Is it an octopus though? Because it's the cuttlefish, right? But is that classified as an octopus?
It's technically not, but they're all cephalopods. So the
I was going to say, because when you said octopus, I'm like, okay.
Octopus is a common word that people understand.
Okay, so cool. Like, gotcha. Because I'm just thinking like the cuttlefish has got its tentacles kind of floating behind it, but it's not like doing clever things like opening lids and all sorts of contortions with those tentacles, is it?
They're cephalopods, but I'll use a vernacular word occasionally just to So the octopuses, quotation marks, they're like each one has a different feeling, like Nautilus, which is a very primitive one. It's all about social hierarchy. It's like, oh, I got to keep myself here and everything. Sepia, it's all about keeping that safe zone in the domestic sphere, in the home, which is why it's such a polycrest. There are a number of others that have different environments there. So you can see this safe zone, and then this group of animals journeys through it. They kind of advance through those layers or columns or whatever you want to call them, these phases of human development. And then they gradually become more advanced. And you can kind of see in the table, the more advanced the superphyla, the more advanced, like the closer they get to like kind of the end, you might say. The next is the Ecdysozoa. So the Ecdysozoa are the animals that shed their skins, not snakes, everyone but snakes. But the Ecdysozoa are the animals that shed their skins. So the spiders, the insects, the molting thing, and the nematodes. These ones took me on a great journey. So the very primitive one, all of these concern an other. They feel themselves to be so super different than the rest of the world. There is nothing alike. There's like nothing in common. As these Ecdysozoa advance, they each deal with it, and they all kind of deal with that fundamental difference between them and the rest of the world. The very primitive ones, the trilobites, which are extinct now, we have remedies made out of fossil. And I was actually really interested by this because I proved one and then Martine Mercy proved one. And we came to almost the exact same conclusions. Like our remedies were super similar. And I was really happy about that. Has happened a couple of times. They are all about like avoiding the other. So they'll just like, oh, well, okay, I'm different than them. See ya. The one I did, Elrathia kingi, is about concealment. And Martine did another trilobite. I think she did a flexicalamine, and it had a different strategy. The next being the chelicerates. The chelicerates are the spiders and also the horseshoe crabs. They are going to make the outside world be like them. There's this forcing aspect of it. In the more primitive ones, like the scorpions, they're pretty direct about it. They're like Androctonus. You're going to be the way I want you to be. You're going to be like me. You're going to do this, or I'm going to beat the living daylights out of you.
Oh,
I'm
my word. So there's a bit of that going around in the world at the moment.
Oh, there is. That's actually pretty atypical among the scorpions. Others like Scorpio Europia, their strategy is just like inconsistency. I love you. I love you. I love you. I love you. Then you do something. I hate you. They kind of go through that. They do that swing between them to get people wrapped around their fingers and everything else. Like, and then the spiders themselves will actually employ deception. And as the spiders become more advanced, the deception becomes even more sophisticated until it reaches... So it becomes really good in some of the house spiders and like Latrodectus and everything. So they are really sophisticated at manipulating people and getting them there.
Your understanding, I'm just like hanging on every word you're saying, Paul, because like your understanding of the different superphyla and the animal, it's so amazing, because you can have a case in the clinic and it can be a case of, I don't know, anything like low self-esteem or something I see quite a lot in the clinic. And there can be so many different remedies, but the subtleties of like why you would choose this remedy over another can be sometimes really hard to understand it. But it's so interesting chatting with you because you so clearly understand those very subtle differences of why you would choose the one over the other, which is really, it's really cool to listen to. Sorry, continue.
Oh, thank you. So the next being the crustaceans. We don't have many, but they're all... It's like, oh, they tend to get like a little bubble around them. It's like, all right, there's an other. there's me, we're different. I'm going to have this only in this limited area. Everyone else get out.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar. You see that a lot in like Homarus and Asticus and everything like that. And next, there is the insects. The insects I so adore. They contact the other and they transform themselves thereby. They actually transform themselves into the other. There's that theme of transformation in them, and that in a certain way, they lose their difference. It is really beautiful to behold. And each kind of separate group of insects does so in a different manner. They each have a different domain they connect to the other in, a different reaction and everything, but it reaches its ultimate expression in the butterflies.
Mm.
And the interesting thing about the butterflies is the butterflies, they kind of move past that to, they move past that kind of column five other thing to, they move to column seven, that fulfillment thing. They share that with the birds.
Mm.
The issue that they need to get that, achieve their purpose, to transform themselves, to really become part of like earth life and the world around them, is the issue of the plant that they host on. So in my book, I actually do have a little chart, and I have Michal Yakir's kind of schema in there. And like, these are the butterflies that we know that host on this plant. These are the butterflies that we know that host on these plant families. And it hooks up perfectly. Like, look at Acherontia atropos.
I've described that one a lot.
That is a scary remedy.
Do
you know what it hosts on?
I don't actually.
Solanaceae.
Oh, of course. Okay, well, that makes complete sense now. Yeah, wow. Actually, the Acherontia, yeah, I prescribed the death's head hawk moth. That was the, I mentioned on the podcast a couple of times, but that is the death's head hawk moth that is on the movie poster for The Silence of the Lambs. And it's, and the theme of the remedy has a lot to do with being forced to do something they don't want to do. And I prescribed that a lot during COVID, especially when we had the mandates here and a lot of people were forced to take the vaccine. They didn't want to take it. And that remedy was transformational for so many of them. And yeah, and of course, being a moth, it was quite interesting then later on, because the Novavax vaccine was actually ended up made with the cells of a moth. So, I mean, all of that, you just couldn't make it up. It was quite creepy. But you've just really, because we had a little chat about butterflies before we started recording, and I love prescribing the butterflies, but I haven't made that plant connection thing, which is cool because there's not much information out there on the monarch butterfly. But I know that the monarch butterfly feeds on swan plants, because we used to have some monarch butterflies and we used to have swan plants, and it was so beautiful seeing the caterpillars on there and then the chrysalis and the butterfly coming out. So I don't know any information about the swan plant, but it's got these beautiful, actually, I showed Amy that the other day. She said it looks like hairy balls, but it's got this fluffy thing on it with spiky things sticking out of it, which will be interesting to, because I often prescribe monarch butterfly for mothering and nurturing. And if there's issues with a mother or anything, like somebody might have had a bad childhood or bad relationship with their mother when they were young and they've never been able to move past that, some of the things that I might prescribe it for. But I don't know much about the swan plant, so you've, and there's not much materia medica on monarch butterfly, so you've inspired me to go and do some research.
But the swan plant is, at least in the monarchs we have in North America, I'm not sure if this is true in Australia, that's are on the Asclepiadaceae. So the Asclepiadaceae are gentianales, also a column six remedy, but they're all like, we see it, remedies like Nux Vomica and Gelsemium in there. And what are the other ones? Oh, those are the big ones. But the outside world, the social world and everything, bleh, like they just, there's this automatic like, rejection.
With that plant?
With that plant family, they just it's the outside world. Yuck. Like there's just this visceral reaction against it. Like, I can't stand the world.
Interesting.
And that's really what they.
Okay, so that's so cool to know. And this is where the interconnectedness of it all and the sometimes the overwhelmingness of it all is, of course, then every plant is made up of minerals. And sometimes it's worth knowing for example, bamboo, that's what, 80% silica. So if you have a mineral patient that's not, you know, silica is indicated, but they don't do that well, then you might have to prescribe bamboo, which is 80% made up of silica. But then you look at the insects, I guess that goes for all insects, possibly not just butterflies.
Is closely associated with a plant, but many are.
Okay.
We've got Coccus cacti, which is a member of the Hemiptera, but it also goes on a cactus. And you see both very clearly in the picture. Same thing with Aphis chenopodium glauci. actually the Chenopodium, the Chenopodium is very closely related to the cactuses. So they've got very similar pictures there. Uh-huh. But yeah, no, plants, if you know to prescribe butterflies well, you got to understand plants well. But when you do, gorgeous. Like it's just great. And that is the Ecdysozoa. The last remedy group is the Deuterostomia. That includes the vertebrates, but it also includes things like the echinoderms, the starfish, and a couple of other things. And this one is all about consciousness. They bring consciousness to their particular domains of where they are. This ranges from, say, the fish, which bring consciousness to their immediate environments. This goes to the squamates, which are like the theme that me and Angelica eventually picked for the squamates. So the squamates are the lizards and the snakes. Zoologically, you can't really separate them. And homeopathically, you can't really separate them either. They're part of the same kind of thing. Is let my will, not thy will, be done. They're all about, they're bringing consciousness to their own will, their own need to create things around them. Very similar to a spider, but coming from a different place. The spider's coming to the need to enforce things from this like frenetic place, like, the outside world is crazy, versus the squamates, the snakes and the lizards. They're like, oh, well, I need to make the world and you in particular, usually their family, the way I want you to be because my way is better. Like, I love snake remedies. I think we have a nasty reputation of them. And I have a lot of snake relatives and patients and everything. And they are wonderful, loving people. But you just got to get over this. Like, I want to do this. This is what I want to do. This is my will to do this. And if they're in a good state, they can be like, yes, I understand that. That is, I get that on a deep level. And then you can do that. Aww. Versus the mammals. The mammals are like bringing consciousness to society to the extent that like, oh, the archetypical mammal problem is that something is wrong with society. They are more morally advanced than the society they live in. And then they are getting into a huge conflict over that. I mean, my favorite remedy in that is not like the first mammal that I proved there was Trichechus. So what's Trichechus that? Is the Florida manatee.
Okay.
So they have an inclination. They have a sexual inclination that's not embraced by society. In the old days, you could think of like a closeted gay guy or a closeted lesbian or something like that. Mm-hmm. They have some inclination that society does not do, and they feel great shame over that. Mm-hmm. There's concealment. There's a lot of like psychotic discharges from the eyes and potentially STIs as well. Mm-hmm. And when they do start to conceal it, it can get not just socially disapproved of, but it can become pathological. Mm. Imagine people who start to develop like just sexual predilections that become more and more extreme, things like porn addiction and so forth. It can become very, very pathological in that concealed thing. Mm. The healed state of the remedy is, oh, this is what I am. This is it. It is not just for society to treat me badly this way. And their healed state is being open about this and going through that. Mm. All of the mammals have this. There's this fundamental issue of injustice. So people are doing something wrong to them. And how they deal with that is just how they navigate. Like, that's how they navigate life. That's how they navigate their thing. The healed state for them is to be like, oh, this is not right. This is not just. I'm going to change this socially.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yes. You can see what this is. So there is this journey, and the birds, their whole thing is just contacting this energy beyond the self, going beyond just their small individual identity and achieving their purpose, figuring out what they're for in life, really expanding into that. The early, more primitive birds, like the geese, the chickens and things like that, they really are about kind of overcoming social obstacles to this. But the neo-avs proper really, really succeed. Mm. It's like I did a really good proof of chicken feather. And chicken feather is like, it's the ultimate remedy for a Karen. It is the archetype of the Karen.
They are
people that are locked into this social system and they have to adopt a persona to stay there, to stay involved in this, to stay as a part of society. This persona is just this hypercritical Karen-y one that is just super fake and everything else like that. And then they become, and then they, as they can maintain this and keep a distance between their true selves and this persona. But as health declines, they will not be able to do this. They become really hypercritical. They get fixated on controlling minute details. Mm-hmm. Like, my God, you didn't get my drink right. I wanted an umbrella, not a straw. And there can be these huge displays of anger and everything else like that until the end of their pathology. They can't maintain the persona anymore. And they get kicked out of their society and they're alone. And bereft. Their healed state is to be like, all right, well, we all need a persona to a certain extent. It doesn't affect them. There's the persona here. Maybe they adopt a couple of social mores or anything, but they are still themselves, even in the midst of that. Like, that's the healthy chicken state.
I'm just giggling because I've got chickens, and it's really funny when you say that. Like, I'm just thinking of one hen in particular. I'm like, yep, she would be a Karen.
Yeah, it's the ultimate remedy for caroning and so forth. And there's a number of others that I've been doing right now. Like, I just wrote up Flamingo and Zenate and the Morning Dove because they're the most primitive of the modern birds, the neoabs and everything. So I just wrote them up and I'm writing up Cuculus right now, which strangely enough didn't have much of it. So the cuckoo is a brood parasite, but that didn't show up in the proving I did at all. So, I mean, maybe it shows up if people prove it, but it didn't show up like at all. So, and I was a little surprised about that, but...
That's very interesting.
It's still a really good picture.
I just want to put a disclaimer here that I actually really don't like the word Karen because I feel really sorry for anybody who's named Karen. I think as a society, we need to choose a different word. I mean, we're using that word because that's like, you know, you can say that word and everybody knows what it means. But I actually had a big chat with my kids the other day because they asked me, they're 11 and 8, and they said, Mummy, why do people talk about a Karen? We don't talk about that in our house. They must have heard it somewhere. And so we had to kind of explain that to them and say that that's not actually a nice way to talk about people. If your name is Karen and you're listening, I have lots of good friends called Karen, and just don't let that get you under.
I love Karens in general. This is not intended towards anyone specific. Yes. Karen, I'm speaking. It's funny, even if we chose a different word, that archetype, that trope, for those people, right?
You do. Like, we just need to get a different name for it. We just need to get a different name for it because I guess I haven't, because my... I have a name thing, and that's why, you know, at the start of the podcast, we actually recorded that, but I pronounced your surname wrong. I said Theriou instead of Teriou, and I have a thing with names, so I like to pronounce it correctly. It's probably, my name is actually Eugenie, which is, my mom called me Eugenie in South Africa, but then I discovered actually the French pronunciation is Eugenie, but then I came to Australia and it just got bastardized to Eugenie, and to the point where I have now accepted the name Eugenie, and I just call myself that because I just can't be bothered explaining it to people anymore. So I actually started out as a joke. My husband would call me Eugenie to annoy me a few years ago, and then I got to Australia and then everyone called me that, and now I'm just like, I've just embraced it and I call myself Eugenie.
Yes, but anyway
sorry to all the Karens. We just did a little side avenue there.
Personal slight. I'm speaking to the archetype.
Yeah, the archetype, not the name. Yes. I just wanted to say with this, I really like Peter Fraser's little booklets as well. And he's got this one here about spiders. And I was reading the intro here the other day, and I thought it's so interesting that, you know, where spiders are based, like obviously you get the ground spiders as well, but that they're kind of suspended between the earth and the sky. They're in this weird little place. And I see them every night because we've got a lot of spiders out where I live. And at nighttime, they have their webs everywhere outside. And it's gone during the day, but at nighttime it's there. And this particular spider, which is exactly where I have to go feed the dogs. It's so annoying because every night I walk straight into his trap, and I should know by now, and I do think it's funny. They're not of the earth. They're not of the sky. They're just somewhere kind of in the middle. You must have had just so much fun exploring all these different avenues and all these, I mean, you could really lose yourself in this, can't you?
Oh, I never lost myself. I mean, so my personal remedy is a radioactive metal. Ooh. So a radioactive metal is, you expand the self and you just need to keep the self together. Otherwise I fragment into fatigue or explode. That, I think that constitution is very well suited towards this because I never lost myself by expanding into all of these. It was always just another way of being me that I discovered when I was exploring these. So I never had that problem.
Well, apparently mine's a drug remedy. So,
which one?
I don't know if I want to say.
Oh, I don't feel the need to say if you don't.
Only I wouldn't. I'll tell you afterwards. But I know, like, a lot of the listeners will go and look it up or wonder, like, why is that? But I saw Anna Vivak about a year ago, or so, and she prescribed this remedy, and actually, it made perfect sense. And when I have since prescribed the remedy myself to some of my clients, but I'd never prescribed it before, and so it was very interesting. So anyway, I'll leave it at that. But I'll tell you after.
So I've never lost myself just because. That is my natural state, is always expanding consciousness and experiencing a new thing of that. And these were just new things for me to get into. And I am very good at turning them off. It's like, all right, you're staying in, you know, I'm doing a bird now. You're staying in the bowl. Stay there all tomorrow. Yeah.
Well, we are very lucky that you are like that, because now we can benefit from the amazing work that you do. And I'm so blown away by your work. You are so young. And you're doing all this stuff, and you still, like you've just told me before we started recording, you've seen 15 patients today. Like, I don't know where you find the energy to do everything that you're doing. It's mind blowing. I mean,
I'm starting to take more time off now. I'm starting to take more time off. I was dealing with the chronic exhaustion there for a little bit. So I'm taking a day off a week now. So I'm good now. I feel a lot better. So my husband really demanded that of me. He's like, you know what, Paul? I'm like, all right, one day. And it turned out to be really good. So it's a lot, but I'm getting there. So.
We're lucky when we have these people in our lives that bring us back to center or back to ground, because my husband's that person for me as well. He pulls me back when I'm just off into homeopathy, la-la land on 100 different tangents, and he'll bring me back. He's like, no, you need to be with us right now. And I'm so grateful to him for doing that. And I see beautiful pictures of you and your hubby on Instagram, on Facebook now and again. That's what's been probably one of the funnest part of doing this podcast, connecting with homeopaths around the world and then getting to kind of get a little glimpse into their personal lives and seeing all the amazing things that they're doing. And you just think, how are you creating all these bodies of work and you still have a personal life as well? It's quite mind-blowing. You must have a very supportive partner.
Well, it's funny because, like, if you don't have a personal life, I don't think you should be creating these things. If you don't have that foundation, that, I mean, what is it? In Kabbalah, which I learned a lot about from Michal, even though I don't study, you start the advanced studies when you're in your 40s and you've raised a family and you've got like a life, a stable person and everything else like that. If you don't have those foundational things there, like relationships and friends and that kind of thing, you probably shouldn't be doing this. You'd probably work on that. So I do think I've got those things. I've got a really good group of friends together. Like, oh my God, our best friends are like a gay throuple and myself and another gay single person. We have so many funny gay dramatic adventures. It's just delightful. And I've got my family and my adorable little nephew and everything.
Oh, I saw photos of him. Yeah.
He's so cute. He just learned how to walk yesterday. And he's so cute. So you can't do your work to the exclusion of the good side of life and the humanity and everything like that. You need to have both of those things in, even if you do need someone to remind you to be present. And it's like, sweetie, we're doing this right now. Stop thinking. Or my guy, Paul, we're doing this right now. Stop thinking about cranial bones and stop thinking about birds and whatever. And, you know. Iodine, whatever I'm on. Yes. So
Paul, it's been so, so fun to chat with you. Thank you so much. Can you tell our listeners where they can get hold of all your books? Like, where for you is the best place that people buy them? Because I know there's probably lots of different places, but I always want to make sure that when we have authors on the show, that we direct our listeners to the place where the author is most going to benefit from the proceeds of the sales.
So on my website, drpaulterio.com, there's a thing called publications. It's not a great thing, but it's got everything that I've published on there, including like free articles and things. But the best place to buy them is on lulu.com. Okay. So you just go search my name and everything will come up. I don't sell on Amazon because Amazon is giving me literally no money. Even though I went through all the official things, it wasn't people pirating, it was me. But at the same time, it's like, oh, we sold all these copies on Amazon. You get 13 cents. I'm like, you know what, Jeff Bezos, I do not feel like paying for your divorce.
Well, anyway, that's really I don't sell on Amazon. I talked on the show before of the lovely Jill Turland. You know, she turned 80 in November and she actually hasn't seen any proceeds of the sales of her book for years. Because a printer screwed her over and started selling fake copies of her book on Amazon. And so there's all these homeopaths around with copies of her book, which, you know, are not the correct copies. And she hasn't received a cent from. So I now sell her books as well and send her a commission check directly from me. So just to make sure that, and she was so grateful. It's like the first time she'd received money from her book in years. I don't know how people can do that. I mean, how do people, I don't know how people live with themselves when they do that. But anyway, so yeah, good on you for not selling on Amazon. And so we'll tell our listeners to go to your website or go to lulu.com, and then they can go and delve into this amazing world of animals and yeah, start using it in practice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Such a pleasure. We'll talk again very soon.